Chapter 15. Eleanor was a world transformed. In the hands of the greenskin, it had been reduced to a rough world of reeking lairs and filth-choked encampments. Astartes' war had cleansed its surface with scarifying fury that swept all before it. Yet, for all its ferocity, it could not compare with the industry of the Mechanicum. Four labour fleets of geoformers went to work on the rugged hinterlands that had housed the feral warlords of the savages, levelling the world's largest continent as a stage befitting the master of mankind. Millions of servitors, automatons and penal battalions went to work on its construction, reducing mountains to rubble and using the debris of their grinding down to fill the lightless valleys and even out the undulant wastelands where the greenskin had lit his revel fires and thrown up his ugly fortresses of mud and clay. What should have taken centuries took months, and as squadron after squadron of thunderhawks of the Thousand Suns broke through the acrid clouds of smog and dust hanging over Ulanor, it was a sight calculated to take a viewer's breath away. The ground below was a polished granite mirror, a terrazzo landmass that shone like the angel glass of the ancient court astronomer. Vitrified craters had been melted into the landscape and filled with promethium. Searing flames turned the sky orange and sent towering pillars of smoke into the heavens. A laser straight road, half a kilometre wide and 500 long, cut through the heart of the craters, its extremities marked by trophy posts bearing the bleached, fleshless skulls of green-skinned brutes. Almost obscured by the smoke, hundreds of enormous vessels hung in low orbit, their engines straining against the pitiless attraction of gravity. The atmosphere clashed with chain lightning from the blistering electromagnetic fields each vessel generated. Flocks of strike cruisers, fighter aircraft and bombers flew formation overhead, the roar of their engines a wordless vocalization of primal glory. The vermilion starships of the Blood Angels jostled for position with the fabulously ornamented vessels of the Emperor's Children. Phalanx, the mighty golden fortress of the Imperial Fists, dominated its segment of the sky, defying the laws of nature by hanging immobile above the earth. The battle-scarred flagships of the Khan, Angron, Lorgar and Mortarion flew above the mirrored ground alongside their brother Primarch ships. Yet supreme amongst them was a gilded warship that held anchor above the one element of the continent, not planed flat by the industrial melters of the Mechanicum. This was the Vengeful Spirit, command ship of Horus Lupercal, second only to Phalanx in its savage power of destruction. Entire worlds had died by its lethal arsenal, and Horus Lupercal had shown no restraint in unleashing its full fury. 14 legions had answered the Emperor's summons, 100,000 of the greatest warriors in all human history, and 9 of the Primarchs were in attendance, the rest too scattered by the demands of the Crusade to reach Ulanor in time. 8 million soldiers of the Imperial Army had come, and a dizzying plethora of banners, battle flags, trophy standards and icon poles were rammed into the ground in the centre of each armed camp. They stood proud alongside thousands of armoured vehicles and hundreds of titans of the Legio Titanicus. Towering above the mortal soldiers, the treads of the mighty battle engines were like a city of steel on the march. The Thousand Suns were amongst the last legion forces to make planetfall. The entire continent sweltered like a blacksmith's forge, the hammer of history ready to beat the soft metal of existence into its new form. Only an event of galaxy-changing magnitude could warrant such a spectacle. Only the greatest being in the galaxy could inspire such devotion. This was to be a gathering like no other. Adamant fixed the Primarch's cloak to the pauldrons of his armour, hooking the bone catches on a clasp in the form of an upthrust talon. He settled it around Magnus's shoulders, letting the flowing lines of iridescent feathers mould to his frame. Magnus stood at the centre of the spiral within his sanctum, the glass pyramid brought in pieces from the Fotep and rebuilt upon the perfectly flat surface of Ulanor. The crystalline panels shimmered orange in the light of the giant fires outside, but Magnus's mastery of the arts of the Pavoni kept the temperature within perfectly cool. Under normal circumstances, Amon would attend upon the Primarch, but on this momentous day, Magnus had requested Adamant prepare him, fastening the plates of his armour to his muscle frame and ensuring he was not outshone by his brothers. "How do I look?" asked Magnus. "You will certainly attract attention," said Adaman, stepping back from his Primarch. "And why should I not attract attention?" countered Magnus, throwing out his arms in operatic gesture. "Am I not worthy of it? Fulgrim and his warriors may quest for perfection, but I embody it." The Primarch was clad in all his finery, the gold of his armour shimmering bright in the flickering torchlight. His horned breastplate was thrusting and magnificent, his helmet barely able to contain his slicked crimson hair, which was bound in three long scalp locks. He bore twin blades, sheathed across his back, and carried a hecker-staff of gold and emerald, his chained grimoire partially concealed in a long kilt of leather and mail. "It's not the sort of attention I think you want," said Adaman. "I have seen the way the other legions look at us." He hesitated before speaking again, giving voice to the fear that had plagued him in the 2 months since departing the Arkreach cluster, like they did when the flesh change was still rife. Magnus turned his gaze upon him, the emerald green of his eye matching the gemstones on his hecker-staff. "The symbol of Thothmes holds within my sanctum, so none may hear your words, but make no mention of the flesh change beyond these walls," warned Magnus. "That curse is behind us. When the Emperor brought you all to Prospero, I ended the degradation of the gene seed and restored biological harmony to the Thousand Suns." Magnus reached down and placed a hand on Adaman's shoulder. "Too late for your brother, I know, but soon enough to save the Legion. I know, but after seeing what happened to Hastar..." "An aberrant mutation, a one-in-a-billion fluke," promised Magnus. "Trust me, my son, that can never happen again." Adaman looked up into Magnus's eye, seeing the power that lay in his heart. "I do trust you, my lord," he said at last. "Good. Then we will speak no more of this," said Magnus with finality. With Magnus at their centre, the Sekhmet marched across the mirror-smooth surface of the continent towards the one feature that stood proud of the landscape. The mountain had once served as the green-skinned warlord's lair, but it had been erased from the world, its flattened base a steel-skinned dais for the Emperor and his honoured sons. Magnus would take his place alongside his gene-sire with his brothers, Dorn, the Khan, Angron, Sanguinius, Horus, Fulgrim, Mortarion, and Lorgar. The warriors of the Thousand Suns had spent the entire voyage from the Arkreach cluster preparing for this moment, for none wished to be found wanting in the eyes of his brothers. Adaman had picked only the best and most learned of his fellowship to accompany Magnus to the dais, and each had been honoured with a cartouche secured to his armour by a wax scarab. Aura Magma had joked that they should all put out an eye to mark themselves as the chosen of Magnus. No one laughed, but that was Aura Magma's way to carry the joke too far in tastelessness. At the head of the 36 warriors of the Sekhmet were the captains of fellowship, the senior warriors of the Pesaje, who bore the title of Magister Templi. Only Fael Toron of the 7th was absent. His fellowship remained on Prospero to protect his people and train the students who hoped one day to be counted amongst the Thousand Suns. The flickering embers of the tutelaries frolicked in the air above them, basking in the presence of so much raw, etheric energy. Some of that was the invisible aftertaste of the Xenos species that had once called this rock home. It was as crude and powerful as a flamethrower, but its potency was equally short-lived. 8PO followed in Magnus's etheric slipstream, while Utipa prowled the edge of their group, with Paok and Ephra, each one a shifting, formless mass of light and wings and eyes. The air of Ulinar still bore traces of the greenskin, despite the seared reek of the Promethean basins and the lingering aroma of gun oil and Astarte's biochemicals. Exhaust fumes hung in low-lying smog banks, and the burnt metal taste of the Mechanicum machines was a sour reek of exotic oils and unguents. Thousands of Astartes filled the plain, as far as the eye could see, preparing for their triumphal march. Though this was perhaps the most heavily armed planet in the Imperium, there was tension in the air, a volatile mixture of martial pride and superiority, common among gatherings of fighting men of different origins. Each group of warriors measured the others, deciding which was the strongest, the proudest, and the most courageous. Adaman marched alongside Magnus, feeling the wariness of his brother warriors as they stared at his magnificent Primarch. "I never thought to see so many Astartes gathered together," Adaman said to Magnus. Yes, it is impressive, agreed Magnus. My father always knew the value of the symbolic gesture. They won't forget this. They'll carry tales of it to the far corners of the galaxy. But why now? Asked Adaman, when the crusade is in its final stages. A shadow crossed Magnus's face, as though Adaman's question had strayed into a region he disliked. Because this is an epochal moment for humanity, he said, a time when great change is upon us. Such times require to be marked in the race memory of the species. Who among us will ever experience a moment like this again? Adaman was forced to agree with that sentiment, but as they drew near to the first checkpoint in the perimeter around the Emperor's dais, he realized that Magnus had neatly diverted his question. A pair of warlord titans stood sentinel on the approaches to the sheared root of the mountain, clad in gold and bearing the thunderbolt and lightning motif of the Emperor. The titans had come from Terra to protect their lord and master. His mightiest Praetorians, these titanic custodians, with a perfect blend of technology and martial spirit. "Bigger than the one you have propped up outside the Pirae Temple," said Hathor Mart to Colophus as they marched between the engines. "That they are," agreed Colophus, missing or ignoring Mart's mocking tone. "But war isn't always won by the warrior with the biggest gun. Canis Vertex is a predator and would take both these fine fellows with it before it went down. Size is all very well, but experience, that's what counts. And Canis Vertex earned its fair share on Coriovallum." "We all did," agreed Phocis Tekar sagely. "But when you talk about Canis Vertex, don't you mean it was a predator?" "We'll see," said Colophus with a grin. "A titan wouldn't worry me," said Hathor Mart. "It's just a machine, a big one, I'll grant you. But without the princeps to command it, a titan is simply a giant statue. For all their skill, the Mechanicum haven't yet invented a machine that doesn't need a human being to control it. I could agitate the water molecules in the princeps' skull until his head exploded, boil the blood in his veins, or send millions of volts through his carapace to electrocute the crew." "I could bring it down easily enough," said Phocis Tekar playfully. "I did once before, remember?" "Yes," said Uthizar, "we all remember. You never tire of telling us how you saved the Primarch from a titan on Agoru." "Exactly," said Phocis Tekar. "After all, the bigger they are..." "The bigger mess they make of you when they tread on you," finished Araman. "We are here to escort the Primarch, not to indulge your fantasies of how powerful you are." Beyond the Titans, hulking golden warriors in the armour of the Custodes protected every approach to the hub of the continent, giant warriors of equal aspect to the Astartes, with plates of brazen gold inscribed with curling script, bedecked with fluttering oath papers secured with wax seals. Six of them manned the checkpoint, with a trio of land raiders growling behind them and a pair of dreadnoughts to further augment their strength. "First, Titans, now this. You think they expect trouble?" asked Hathor Mart with a smile. "Always," said Araman. "Surely these security measures are ridiculously overblown and unnecessary. After all, who would dare attempt something hostile on a world crowded with Astartes and the best war machines the Imperium has at its disposal?" "Have you ever met a Custodes?" asked Phocis Tekar. "No. What has that got to do with anything?" "If you had, you would know how stupid that question is." "I met one on Terra before setting out for Prospero," said Adaman. "A young ramrod straight warrior named Valdor. I believe the Primarch knows him." Magnus grunted, telling them everything they needed to know about that acquaintance. "What was he like?" asked Uthizar. "Can't you tell?" asked Hathor Mart. "What's the matter? Don't you read minds any more?" Uthizar ignored the captain of the Third Fellowship, and Araman smiled as Magnus turned to face his officers with a mock-serious expression. "Enough," said Magnus. "Captains or not, you will not be permitted to pass onwards if the Custodes decide you are not of a serious enough mindset. Their word is absolute, and not even a Primarch can go against it in matters of the Emperor's safety." "Come on, Azik," pressed Hathor Mart. "What was this Valdor like?" Magnus nodded indulgently, and Araman said, "He was a grimly efficient Praetorian, if rather humourless. I suppose when you are part of the Carda, responsible for the safety of the greatest being in the galaxy, there is little room for levity."
"Little," said a voice appearing at Araman's side. "There is no room whatsoever."
How the Custodes had come upon Magnus and the Sekhmet, Araman could not fathom. He had not sensed their nearness or caught the faintest tremor in the ether of their presence.
One minute they had been approaching the checkpoint, the next their Tuileries had vanished in the blink of an eye, and two custodes warriors were alongside them. They were tall, as tall as the Astartes, though their armour was nowhere near as bulky. It had a ceremonial look to it, but Adaman knew that was a misleading interpretation, one calculated to give the warriors encased within the advantage. So like Astartes, and yet so different, like distantly related kin gone their separate ways and evolved into new forms. They held long guardian spears, lethal pole arms that could cut through sheet steel with ease and could sever the ogre-like body of an armoured greenskin in two with a single blow. Red horsehair plumes spilled from their tapered helmets like waterfalls of blood, and the green glow of their helmet lenses was eerily similar to that of the Thousand Suns. Gilded carvings snaked from the seals of their neck plates, curling around their shoulders and down the inner facings of their breastplates. "Halt, and be recognized," said the warrior who had spoken before, and Adaman focused all his attention on him. He could sense nothing, not even an echo of his presence in the world, as though he were as insubstantial as a hologram. Adaman's throat felt dry, and an unpleasantly bitter aftertaste flooded his mouth. "Untouchables," said a voice in his mind, with a familiar flavour, powerful but not powerful enough. Adaman could not see them, but with the knowledge that there were psychic nulls nearby, he found he could identify them by their very lack of presence. "Six of them," he said over his armour's suit-vox.
"Seven," corrected Magnus. "One is more subtle than her compatriots in veiling her presence."
The custodes crossed their spears, barring their path to the Emperor's dais, and Adaman's anger flared at the insult implied by the presence of the untouchables. Magnus stood before the custodes, his physique imposing and threatening, his crested helmet a larger version of those belonging to the warriors before him. For an instant, it looked as though Magnus was one of them, a towering, golden-armoured warrior lord. Magnus leaned down, his eye tracing a path over the inscriptions that flowed across the burnished golden plates of the leftmost warrior.
"Amon, Toramak, Ziergaze, Lepron, Cairn, Hedrossa," said Magnus. "I would go on, but the rest of your name is hidden within the curve of your armour. And Hado Vanita, Erdash, Zhu Jiaojiao, Fane, Morovia, Trajan. Fine names, indeed, displaying grand heritage and exceptional lineage, but then I would expect nothing less of Constantine's warriors. How is the old man these days?"
"Lord Valder abides," said the warrior that Magnus had identified as Amon.
"I expect he does," said Magnus, reaching out to touch the beginning of the spiralling script on Amon's shoulder. "You have an old name, Amon, a proud name. It is a name born by my equerry, a student of poetry and the hidden nature of things. If the name maketh the man, does that mean you are a similar student of the unknown?"
"Defending the Emperor requires a talent for discerning hidden truths," replied Amon carefully. "I pride myself on having a certain skill in that regard."
"Yes, I see you do. You are an exceptional man, Amon, and I believe you will go far within your order. I see great things ahead for you," said Magnus, before adding, "and for you also, Hado."
Amon inclined his head at the Primarch's comment, and the two guardian spears were lifted aside, allowing Magnus and the Sekhmet to pass.
"That's it?" asked Adaman, as the custodes lowered their weapons.
"The unified biometric verification system has identified and logged your genetic markers within its network," said Hado. "You are who you claim to be."
Magnus laughed and asked,
"Is anyone ever who they claim to be?"
The custodes did not answer, but stood aside to allow them past. The podium was in sight, but one last intercession was to come before Magnus could take his place at the Emperor's side. Even once through all the checkpoints, Adaman could feel the shadowing presence of the untouchables on the periphery of vision and sense. From the Primarch's comment, he surmised that the Watchmen were in fact the Sisters of Silence, the mute sisterhood of untouchables and the guardians of the black ships. How typical to see them and the custodes working hand in hand. This was the inner circle, metaphorically and literally. For here were gathered the mightiest beings in the cosmos, the brightest suns of the most incandescent sire. Here was where the Primarchs gathered before ascending the platform to stand at their father's side.
Ahriman could see the winged angelic form of Sanguinius, the lusty red of his armour contrasting with pale feathers of his wings. Hung with loops of silver and pearl-like glistening tears, the beatific Primarch stood with the Khan, a swarthy warrior, shawled in furs and lacquered leather plate, with a winged-back banner that echoed those of the Lord of Angels. The golden-skinned Urizen held intense discourse with Dawn of the Fists and Angron, while the Phoenician and his cadre of Lord Commanders preened alongside Horus Lupercal and his lieutenants. Fulgrim's white hair shone like a beacon, his perfect features gloriously sculpted. Little wonder the members of his legion prided themselves on their aesthetic with such an example to follow. Magnus swept forward to join his brothers, but before he reached them, a warrior in dusty white armour edged in pale green stepped to meet him. His shoulder guard bore the image of a skull in the centre of a spiked halo, marking him as Death Guard. His posture was bellicose, and Ahriman read his hostility in an instant. "I am Ignatius Grulgor, second company captain of the Death Guard," said the warrior, and Ahriman heard the judgmental tone and the arrogant sneer that spoke of a man without humility. "I do not care who you are, warrior," said Magnus calmly, though the undercurrent of threat was unmistakable. "You are in my way." Like a living statue, the Astartes stood his ground before Magnus. Two mighty warriors in brass, gold, and ash-coloured Terminator armour appeared on either side of Grulgar, long, ebony, hafted scythes held in spiked cestus gauntlets. The harvest blades were dark and heavy with the weight of slaughter they had accumulated. A name leapt to Ahriman's mind. Man-reapers. "Ah, the Nameless Death Shroud," said Magnus, looking around him. "Tell your master to show himself. I know he is here, within 49 paces, if memory serves." Ahriman blinked as a dark outline seemed to flow from a patch of shadow at the foot of one of the Custodes Titans, a tall, gaunt figure in armour of pallid white, bare iron and brass, shrouded in a mantle of storm cloud grey. A bronze rebreather collar obscured the lower part of his hairless skull, and feathers of rancid air gusted from it at regular intervals. The giant figure breathed deeply of these vapours. "Mortarion!" hissed Hathor Mart. His sunken cheeks were those of a consumptive, and the deep-set amber eyes those of a man who has seen horrors without number. Glass vials and filters strung together on Mortarion's breastplate clinked musically as he walked, his strides sepulchral, punctuated by the rap of his enormous scythe's iron base on the polished ground. A long, drum-barreled pistol hung at his side, and Ahriman recognized the merciless form of the lantern, the Shenlongi-designed pistol that was said to unleash the fire of a star in every blast.
"Magnus!"
said the Primarch of the Death Guard by way of a greeting.
"I wondered if you would show your face."
Mortarion's words were brazen. These were brothers, warrior gods crafted by the Emperor to conquer the galaxy in his name. Like all brothers, they squabbled and vied to attract the attention of their father, but this was distilled anger. "Brother," said Magnus, ignoring Mortarion's words, "a great day, is it not? 9 sons of the Emperor gathered together on one world. Such a thing has not happened since."
"I know well when it was, Magnus," said Mortarion, his voice robust and resolute in contrast to his pallid features. "And the Emperor forbade us to speak of it again. Do you disobey that command?"
"I disobey nothing, brother," said Magnus, keeping his tone light. "But even you must recognize the symbolism of our number. 3 times 3... the Pesage of ancient gods, the Occidental Orders of Angels, and the 9 cosmic spheres of the Forgotten Ages."
"There you go again, with talk of angels and gods," sneered Mortarion.
Magnus grinned and moved to take Mortarion's hand, but the Lord of the Death Guard pulled away from him. "Come on, Mortarion," said Magnus. "You are not immune from the music of the spheres. Even you know that numbers are not cast blindly into the world. They come together in orderly, balanced systems, like the formation of crystals or musical chords, in accordance with the laws of harmony. Why else would you insist on keeping these bodyguards within 7 times 7 paces of you?"
Mortarion shook his head and said, "Truly, you are as lost in your mysteries as the Wolf King says." "You have spoken with Russ many times," promised Mortarion. "He has been quite vocal since departing the Arkreach Cluster."
"We know all about what you and your warriors have been doing."
"What is it you think you know?"
"You have crossed a line, Magnus," hissed Mortarion.
"You hold a snake by the tail and bargain with powers beyond your understanding." "No power is beyond my understanding," countered Magnus. "You would do well to remember that." Mortarion laughed, the sound like mountains collapsing.
"I knew a being like you once before," he said, "so sure in his powers, so convinced of his superiority that he could not see his doom until it was upon him. Like you, he wielded dark powers. Our father made him pay with his life for such evil. Have a care you do not suffer the same fate."
"Dark powers," said Magnus, with a shake of the head. "Power is simply power. It is neither good nor evil. It simply is." He pointed to the pistol on Mortarion's side. "Is that weapon evil?" he asked. "Is that great reaper of yours?" "They are weapons, nothing more and nothing less. It is the use men put such things to that makes them evil. In your hands, the lantern is a force for good. In an evil man's hands, it is something else entirely."
"Give a man a gun, and he will want to fire it," said Mortarion.
"So now you are going to give me a lesson in causality and predestination," snapped Magnus. "I am sure Adaman and the Corvidae would welcome your input on the subject. Come to Prospero, and you can instruct my warriors." Mortarion shook his head.
"No wonder Russ petitioned the Emperor to have you censured," he said.
"Russ is a superstitious savage," said Magnus dismissively, "but not before Adaman saw the shock at the Wolf King's action. He speaks out of turn about things he does not understand. The Emperor knows I am his most loyal son."
"We shall see," promised Mortarion.
The Death Lord turned away and marched towards the Emperor's dais as thunderous braying erupted from the war horns of every Titan on Ulanor. "Now what do you suppose he meant by that?" asked Phocis Takar. The Sekhmet fulfilled their duty of seeing their Primarch to the Emperor's sheared mountain podium. Marching in procession alongside the honour guards of the 9 Primarchs who had come to Ulanor. To move in such elevated circles was a notion Adaman found himself hard-pressed to comprehend. The Primarchs took their place upon the steel-sheathed dais, and their honour guards were dismissed. The chance to parade before the Emperor was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for most of the warriors. To know a Primarch was an honour, but to parade before 9 of them in the presence of the Emperor was the stuff of dreams. Adaman would march with his head held high before demigods made flesh, the apotheosis of humanity and genetic engineering, wrought from the bones of ancient science. That 20 such beings could have been created was nothing short of miraculous, and as he surveyed the noble countenances around him, Adaman suddenly felt very small, the tiniest cog in an ever-expanding machine. The notion of the titanic forces at work struck a powerful chord within him, and he felt the power of the great ocean swell in his breast. He saw his metaphor take shape in his mind's eye, a magnificent, planet-sized machine of wondrous artifice working seamlessly in balance with its every cog, gear, and piston. Those mighty pistons thundered, powering the greatest industry and causing the worlds around it to swell with new life and new beginnings. In the midst of the machine, he saw a piston stamped with a snarling wolf's head, its amber eyes glinting like gems. It fired up and down in a bank of similarly embossed piston heads, each with an emblematic design stamped upon it, a golden eye, a white eagle, a set of fanged jaws, a crowned skull. Even as the image formed in his mind, he saw that the wolf's head piston was fractionally out of sync with the other pistons in the machine, working to a different beat, and gradually shifting its direction until it was completely in opposition to its fellows. The machine vibrated in protest, its harmonic balance upset by the rogue piston, and the squeal of metal grinding metal grew in volume. Adaman stumbled and let out a gasp of horror as he saw that the machine would soon tear itself apart. To see such an industrious machine destroyed and reduced to little more than wreckage by a previously unseen defect in its design was truly tragic. He felt a hand on his arm and looked into the face of a startlingly handsome warrior in the pearl-coloured plate of a lunar wolf. The vision of the machine vanished from his mind, but the lingering sorrow of its imminent destruction creased Araman's features with anguish.
"Are you well, brother?" asked the warrior with genuine concern.
"I am," replied Araman, though he felt sick to his stomach.
"He says he's fine," said a massively shouldered brute behind the warrior. Taller than Araman, with a gleaming topknot crowning his skull, he radiated choler and the urge to continually prove himself. "Leave him be, and let's rejoin our companies. The march will begin soon."
The warrior extended his hand, and Araman accepted the proffered grip.
"You will have to excuse Ezekiel," said the warrior. "He forgets his manners sometimes, most of the time, in fact. I am Hastur Sejanus, pleased to know you."
"Azek Araman," he said. "Sejanus, Ezekiel, you are Morneville."
"Guilty as charged," said Sejanus, with a winning smile.
"I said those custodians didn't know security worth a damn," said Phocis Takar, pushing past Araman to pull Sejanus into a crushing embrace.
"Damn, but it's good to see you again, Hastur."
Laughing, Sejanus pulled himself free of Phocis Takar's embrace and punched him on the shoulder as two more warriors in the livery of the Lunar Wolves appeared at his side.
"Good to see you too, brother. Nobody's managed to kill you, then."
"Not for lack of trying," said Phocis Takar, standing back to regard the warriors before him.
"Ezekiel Abaddon and Tarik Torgadon, as I live and breathe, and little Horus Axeman too. I still tell my brothers of the foes we faced together. Do you remember the battles in the slaughterhouses of the Keelakid? Those damned dragons gave us a hard fight, no mistake. There was one, remember, Tarik? The one with the vivid blue hide that almost..."
Little Horus held up a hand to stall Phocis Takar's reminiscence.
"Perhaps we can gather after the triumphal march," he said, adding, "all of us. I would greatly like to meet your fellows and swap more outrageous tales of battle."
Sejanus nodded. "Absolutely," he said, "for I have it on good authority that the Emperor has a great announcement to make. I, for one, do not want to miss it."
"Announcement?" asked Araman, as a shiver of premonition passed along his spine. "What sort of announcement?"
"The kind we'll hear when we hear it," growled Abaddon. "No one knows," said Sejanus, with a diplomatic chuckle. "Horus Lupercal has not yet deigned to tell even his most trusted lieutenants." Sejanus looked back towards the podium with a grin. "But whatever it is," he said, "I suspect it will be of great import to us all."